Good morning.
Good morning.
Yes, opening chant. Thank you.
Opening chant.
So rare to touch a deep and subtle Dharma, having it to see and hear, remember and become. We vow to taste the truth that is right here, and yet so far beyond words.
Now? Thank you. Thank you. Well, last time I gave a Dharma talk, which was about 6 weeks ago, I talked about practicing in hell. Hell is one of the six realms according to Buddhist thought, according to the Buddha's teaching. This time I'm going to talk about the heavenly realm. I'm going to talk about practicing in heaven. So, welcome to heaven. You may ask, why practice in heaven? Isn't heaven where we get everything we want, where everything is just fine, where we can relax? Surely we don't have to still practice and sit and do all these difficult things. No, you do have to practice in heaven. That's my message this morning. I'm going to start with a little review about the six realms. The six realms, there are three positive realms: heaven, the fighting titan realm, and the human realm. And there are three negative realms: the hell realm, the hungry ghost realm, and the animal realm. And this scheme that the Buddha came up with for the six realms is a way of describing our condition. We move from realm to realm. Everyone visits all of these realms. We could think of these realms as places we go after we die, which are sort of these actual places that exist, and if our karma is good here, we might be reborn in heaven. Or if our karma, if we do bad things here, we might be reborn as an animal. But I don't find that very helpful. The more useful way to think about this, I think, is to think of these as psychological states that we move into and out of all of the time. They're not permanent. We stay in them until we exhaust the karma that brought us there. We might visit all six of these realms in a single day. We might get stuck in one of these realms for a long, long time. As Buddhist practitioners, we try to see these realms clearly, to know when we're in them, when we're leaving one, entering another. We try to adopt the appropriate practice in each realm, and ultimately, we try to see that this whole scheme, though useful to practice, is empty. That there really are no realms, there is only this, all is empty. As soon as we give something a name, we've misrepresented it. We have Manjushri here on the altar, the Bodhisattva of wisdom, who helps us with our practice. It helps us to have that image there. But really, there is no Manjushri. And yet there he is. There's no form. Nothing exists independently. And yet here we are. We have to live our lives. So let's look into this six realms thing and see what we can learn from it. I'm just going to go quickly through the six realms and review what they are. The animal realm. Animals are motivated only by the need to survive. They want food. They want the basic things they need. We humans get into this realm, I think, when we're in extreme circumstances. If our survival is threatened, we revert to our animal mode. The hungry ghost realm, another negative realm, these creatures, the hungry ghosts, are creatures who have enormous bellies and tiny mouths. Their mouths are no bigger than the eye of a needle. And so they're always hungry. They are never satisfied. This is the realm of unrequited desire. This is the realm we get into if we're engaging in addictive behavior. This is the realm we get into if love turns into obsession. We can never be satisfied. We're fixated on something, and we need more and more of it. And the hell realm is a place of torment that we get into through negative emotions like worry, fear, and anger. I talked last time about the appropriate practice in hell, which is to allow yourself to be in hell, to fully be there. Something bad happens to us, something genuinely bad, and that's bad enough, but we add to it through worry and fear and anger and obsessing and all of these things that come up. Through denial, basically, that we're in hell. We dwell on how we wish things were different, and we get kind of stuck there because we can't accept things as they are. That's why accepting things as they are is the way out. And I talked about how the solution, the appropriate practice in hell, is patience, which means fully accepting the situation. And I talked about how meditation and mindfulness can help us with that. If we can calm ourselves and see these negative emotions clearly, we begin to observe them as they come up. And then we can meet these emotions. And I asked, how do we meet these emotions? And the answer is gently. The way the Buddha once encountered a giant snake which had entered a religious sanctuary. And a group of people who had this sanctuary could not get the snake to leave. And it was a big problem. And the Buddha said, I would like to spend the night in this sanctuary. And so how did he meet this snake? Did he go looking for the snake to try to drive it out? He did not. He sat in meditation. He sat in meditation for several hours until sometime in the middle of the night he opened his eyes and saw the snake looking right at him. And here's what the Buddha said to him in a voice filled with love and understanding. Dear friend, return to the jungle for your own safety. And the snake did. He left. That's how we meet our negative emotions. We don't run from them. We don't evade them or deny them. We don't try to conquer them. We don't even really try to confront them. We kind of let them be. We kind of let them be what they are and spend some time with them as they really are. We meet them. This allows us to be fully in hell, and this allows us to leave hell. So being in hell and leaving hell are the same thing. And there are three positive realms. One is the fighting titans or asuras. These are beings who love to fight. They love to stir up trouble, and they're always fighting the gods. And it seems a little surprising that this is considered a positive realm, but it is. Maybe that's because the fighting titans are really empowered beings. They're having a good time, even though they're maybe harming some other folks. And then there's the human realm. That's us. That's us. That's where we are now. And this is the best realm in terms of practice. This is the best place to be. Gods are too distracted by their lives of amusement to really do a meditation practice and become awake. Beings in hell are too distracted by their pain and suffering to do their practice. But as humans, we have just the right amount of suffering and joy to become awake. That's interesting, isn't it? I think that tells us a little something about the best use of a human life. Behind this scheme is the idea that being happy all of the time is not really the best use of a human life. That's not really what we're here for. We're here to live this life vividly and genuinely and to be spiritually awake. The thing is to be fully human, to fully embrace suffering, to fully embrace ease, to live our lives with genuineness and honesty, and to help others. And we may have heard that word nirvana, and we think of it as some kind of other state where we're going to be happy all the time and everything is going to be wonderful forever. And we come to Zen Center expecting to attain this, to have a life of constant, uninterrupted bliss. But if we do this, I think we're going to be a little disappointed, because in Zen, we say that nirvana and samsara, samsara being the state of suffering, the cycle of suffering, we say that they're the same. To be fully and genuinely human means to embrace it all. But today I'd like to talk about the heavenly realm, which is also known as the God realm, It's also known as the Deva realm. That's another name for these gods. What is this realm like? Well, these gods in this realm are a little bit like, maybe like Olympian gods or like angels. They get everything they want, or everything they think they want anyway. I have one little description here from Kanzi. He said, "Their material constitution is more refined than ours. Their emotions are less coarse. Their lifespan is longer. They are less subject to suffering than we." So they can have a little suffering, but not too much. And I imagine these gods, and they're often portrayed this way, as maybe living in a kind of palace, you know, a beautiful place, and they have lots of wonderful food, all they want, and plenty of entertainment all the time, and wonderful friends to hang out with, and beautiful gardens, and dancing, and music. You know, it sounds like a big party. It sounds really nice. And I think this would be great for a while. This would be great for a while, but would any of us want this forever? And it's interesting to think that this is what the Buddha had as a young man. When the Buddha was young, his father tried to protect him from the cares of this world and gave him everything he wanted so that he would be constantly distracted, amused, and happy. But it wasn't enough. The Buddha grew a little older and he encountered suffering and he saw that there are problems in this life. And it wasn't enough to just amuse himself. He had to go deeper. So what does all this mean for our practice? That's the question I always like to ask. There are a couple of ways to look at what heaven is, I think. One, we could look at heaven as a superficial place where we're too distracted to practice and we can't be truly happy. So I could talk about how we tend to seek a superficial heaven ourselves, how sometimes instead of kind of facing our difficulties, we might try to seek pleasant distractions, like the Buddha's early life, that we're kind of thinking if we can just keep the party going, we'll be okay. And I can imagine that these special friends that we have in heaven are a little shallow, that it's a little like a cocktail party where everybody talks but nobody listens. And you love to see somebody new because they'll listen to you. And, you know, I could talk about how there's kind of a spiritual death that occurs when you do this kind of thing. But that's not where I'm going. What I find more interesting is when we experience, you know, true, genuine, real happiness, really sweet happiness, that is just, it's wonderful, it's not superficial, and how we manage to screw that up every time. I've been watching this for a long time, just in my own life. Especially when I was younger, it just seemed often that what I was really concerned with was just, you know, kind of having a feeling good about life. And it would seem that things would come together, and I would think, wow, this is really great. You know, things are really together. They're going to stay this way now. And invariably, they would fall apart again. And I think, why did they fall apart? This is terrible. I need them to come together again. And they'd come together, and they would fall apart. And I would think, why did this happen? Was it something I did? I think it was something I did. And it took me years to figure this out. I can tell you it doesn't happen quite as much these days. I'm a lot more steady now. I think things still fall apart a little bit now and then, but without the drama. You know, I think my meditation practice has helped me. Part of it is just getting older, but a lot of it, I think, is my practice. I'd like to talk about a special day I had one time that might help us to understand practicing in heaven. And this was a great day I had with my son Dylan when he was about 8 years old. So this was probably about 16 years ago. Excuse me. I was fairly new to Zen practice. I was fairly new to this area. I had just moved here from Ann Arbor, and we were living in Northfield. And one thing Dylan and I really enjoyed was hockey. When we lived in Ann Arbor, we went to all the home games of the University of Michigan, and we really enjoyed that. And there was a pond pretty close to where we lived that we would go and we'd play a little hockey, and it was a lot of fun. We were just real, real amateurish, but we had a good time. Sometimes there would be other kids there or other adults there, and we'd all play together, and it was great. And we moved here to Northfield, and I was living in a house that was across the street from St. Olaf College, and they had some beautiful grounds there, and there was this little pond over there. And one day, it was a Saturday, I got up and I thought, gee, it'd be fun to play a little hockey today. So I went outside, and there was new fallen snow, you know, maybe about 6 or 8 inches of snow, probably about 8 inches of snow. And it was a beautiful day. It was one of those beautiful winter days where the sun is out, just about the right temperature, you know, probably about 28 degrees, so things aren't melting, cold enough for hockey, yet you're not freezing. And so I got my shovel and I walked back to this little pond, and I cleared a little rectangular skating rink for us, probably just about as big as this room, and made a couple of goals out of snow the way you do, you know. And then I went back home and I said, hey, Dylan, let's play some hockey. I cleared this place on the pond. It's really going to be fun. So he said, sure, that sounds great. So we get our skates and our sticks and our pucks and everything, and we go out there and we start playing hockey. And it's really fun. It's really fun. We're kind of evenly matched because although he was a little kid and I'm an adult, he's a pretty good skater and he had skating lessons. I'm not a good skater at all. So we were fairly evenly matched. So we got into this thing where, you know, when you have two people playing hockey, what do? He guards his goal. He's the goalie and all of the defensemen for his team. And I come in and I try to get past him, you know. And then he does the same thing. And we did this, and it was really fun. And we did this for, it seems like hours. You know, it's been a long time, and I can't remember all the details. But it seems like it was just great. It was so much fun. And I don't remember all the details, but the thing I remember about it was the pausing. Because after a while, we get tired, you know. So we go at it, and somebody scores a goal, and then we're ready to go again. And we just kind of, you know, just kind of stand there breathing, you know. And just, you know, are you ready? Okay. And then we go at it again. And something about that pause, I think, tells me that we were really, really kind of in the moment, you know. And people would go by and they'd smile at us because there was a path nearby. They'd talk to us and say, boy, it looks like you guys are having fun. You know, so I get the idea, wow, this is really a special day. This is really going well. And so, you know, after a while, we went home. And the next week, the next Saturday, I wanted to do this again because it was so much fun. So I got my shovel and went out, cleared the place again because it had snowed again, went and got Dylan. We went out there. We started playing hockey. And something was wrong. I don't know. I can't remember exactly how it was wrong, you know, but I just remember I had this profound sense of disappointment. It wasn't working this week the way it worked last week. You know, maybe the weather wasn't quite the same. Maybe I was tired. Maybe Dylan wasn't really into it this week. You know, maybe he wanted to be doing something else. Maybe I had something on my mind. I don't really know what it was, but we just had that feeling that, wow, it's just not working, you know? It's just not working. And eventually, we gave up and we stopped early. And I was so disappointed because it was such a beautiful day last week. So, like I said, I don't know exactly how it was different, but I think I know why it was different. And I think it was because of my expectations, because of the expectations I brought to this second day. I was so intent on recreating what had happened the week before that I couldn't see what was happening now. Right? We've all had this kind of experience, right? Like, why don't we have this nice pause between the rounds? I'm pausing, but I'm feeling kind of uneasy. You know, why those people going by, why aren't they saying something? You know, they're just walking by. They're not paying attention. So I was reacting to this week with last week's eyes and ears, right? I'm expecting everything to be last week, and so there's a disconnection between myself and the reality of this week. Instead of taking in what was happening and acting appropriately to according to what's happening today, I'm acting appropriately to what happened last week. And so I'm filtering everything this week through my desires and my preconceptions. And I'm not seeing reality. I'm not seeing this day as it is. So what is it that happened on those two Saturdays? What happened on those two Saturdays, you might say, is that I moved from heaven to hell. The first day was heaven, not the superficial kind, but the genuine kind. It was a wonderful day. It was great. But the next Sunday, I was in hell. And I admit it's a minor hell. I mean, it's not a huge problem to have this disappointing day. But I think it's a good example that we can learn from. I was in hell because here I am with my son. I could be having a nice day. I could be enjoying this day as it is, but I'm not. I'm feeling all of this disappointment. My reality was the sense that things should be different. So on the first day, I was really there. I was really there. On the second day, I was grasping, or you might say clinging, defined really by my emotions rather than what was going on. So this is the converse of hell. In hell, we refuse to accept that things are bad, and so we deny reality. In heaven, we refuse to accept that things can change, so we deny reality. So the question I want to ask is, when did this grasping start? What can we learn from that? I think the seeds were sown for the grasping, probably, as soon as I started to realize that it was a really special day. And I would say, wow, this is a beautiful day. This is really special. And I'm filled with gratitude, so I'm not clinging at this point, but something is happening there. I'm separating myself just a little bit from the experience. Instead of being in this moment, I'm stepping back and analyzing the day. So I'm standing back, I'm enjoying the rapture, and this leads then to a lot more mental activity. This is really fun. This makes me feel really good. I'd like to do this a lot more. What can I do? Can I do this again next week? So at this point, I'm completely separate from my immediate experience, right? I'm planning what to do. I'm thinking about how life should be and how I'm going to make it be different, rather than being here really experiencing the game. So if the essence of Zen practice is, and I think it is, the question, what is it now? This was the opposite of Zen practice. This is, what should it be now? So now I'm looking at everything through this false filter. I know what I like, and I know what I don't like. I know that I like fighting over the puck and doing that, looking at the winter sky maybe during the pause. I like that. But, you know, maybe something negative creeps in. Maybe some negative thought creeps in while I'm doing this. Say maybe I haven't done my taxes yet and I should be home doing my taxes. That thought creeps in. And then that leads to more. I have this mountain of work at home I should be doing, you know, and I have this uneasiness. But those things, those little bitty thoughts don't really fit into this new worldview I've constructed of how it should be, how things are now, of how I'm in heaven. And so I just don't acknowledge that little pang of worry, you know. I'll just think about the fun. And pretty soon I'm in this mental battle, which is subconscious, really, which is trying to preserve my new worldview, trying to welcome thoughts about how great this is, and trying to push away thoughts that are inconsistent with that worldview. So I think you can see what's going wrong here, that, you know, there's nothing wrong with the pleasure of the day. It's great to enjoy that Saturday, but it's the clinging that destroys it. It's the clinging that takes me away from the moment. And it was being in the moment that made it special in the first place. But I'm moving away from the moment. And I'm missing half of the stuff that's going on. You know, I'm sort of living in my imaginary reality. I'm seeing what I want to see. So the question then is, what could I have done differently? That was a long time ago, and I've done a lot of Zen practice since then. And I suspect that thing wouldn't happen to me quite as much now. I'd be less likely to recreate what had happened the previous week. And part of this, I think, is just the wisdom that comes with age. You know, you learn not to have so many expectations, because when you do, you'll be disappointed. And that doesn't mean that you have low expectations. It doesn't mean you have low expectations in the sense that you don't expect to enjoy life. It means instead that you're open to what life has to offer. You're going to enjoy it more, actually, because you're going to accept what's there rather than looking for what should be there. So I see five things about Zen practice that have helped me with this, with practicing in heaven, that I would like to talk about. The first is that in Zen practice, we become more aware of our thoughts and feelings. We sit, we face the wall, we meditate, and we come back to our breathing. At least that's one practice. And especially in the beginning, it's very good practice to keep coming back to your breath. And thoughts come, distractions come, you acknowledge you have a thought, and you come back to your breath. You do this over and over. And as we do this, we begin to see how our mind works, because we see these thoughts coming in. We see them coming in over and over. We see how certain thoughts keep coming back. We see how thoughts lead to other thoughts. We see how our mind relentlessly adds commentary to any situation. And just seeing this is a great help. You may sit down and have a sitting in which you're totally distracted and it's nothing but your mind racing. You think, well, that was a big waste of time. That was terrible. That was not a good meditation. That's not true. That was a great meditation, because you're seeing how your mind works. You're seeing how your mind works. And if you do that enough, it's going to stop. It's going to calm down. And sometimes you'll sit down and you will be surprisingly quiet. But if I had been a little more aware that day, that first Saturday, I think that I would have seen this grasping. You know, if I had had more experience with meditation, had been accustomed to watching my mind, I would say, look what I'm doing. I'm trying to hang on to this moment. Look what I'm doing. I'm planning next week. I shouldn't be planning next week. I'm going to come back. I'm going to come back. The second thing we do in Zen practice that I'd like to talk about is we come back to the moment again and again. In sitting, we're facing the wall and we're led astray. We come back again and again to our immediate experience, which is our breath, if we're following our breath. Or maybe it's how we feel physically. But whatever it is, we keep coming back. We keep coming back. We keep asking, what is it? What is it? What is it now? What is it now? And I think through experience, you know, we can learn to look at distracting things as signals that we're not in the moment. As an example of that, I can think of song lyrics. You know, I've been dogged for years by song lyrics in my head when I'm trying to sit. I don't know if this happens. Not lyrics so much, but it's just a song, you know. This may happen to you. It just keeps coming back. It keeps coming back. And what I've learned to do is I just see that as a signal of you're not in the moment. If this song is here, you're not in the moment. And it's time to come back to the moment. And that doesn't mean, okay, Ted, we're going to gather our forces and our strength here and we're going to come back to the moment. It's no, come back to the moment right now. Right now. You hear that song and just come back to what's here. And I find that's very helpful. And that same thing could have happened that day on the pond, you know, if I had been more aware. I have a thought. I'm starting to plan next week. I'm having a thought where I'm starting to think, wow, this is really great. I just want to kind of sit, enjoy the rapture a little bit. I could have thought, you know what that is, Ted? That's you going off. Come back to the moment. You know, it's about these trees here. Look at this tree. It's about this hockey puck. It's about your son smiling here. It's not about all that other stuff. The third thing we do that I think can help us in this is that we do this practice for others. Not for ourselves. We do this practice for others. Central to Buddhism is, to Mahayana Buddhism, is the concept of the Bodhisattva, a being who renounces complete entry in nirvana until all are saved. A being who exists to help other people. That's where the practice leads us. And if I had remembered this that day, I think that would have helped too. That would have helped too, because if I had concentrated more on my son instead of enjoying my own ecstasy, you know, that would have taken me out of myself. It would have taken me out of this mental activity that I was adding to the situation. And it would have really helped to keep me there to prevent this from sort of going off into something I wanted to grasp at. And the fourth thing is that we make continuous effort. That means even when things go well, we make a continuous effort. This is important to remember. I think, you know, we don't want to come to Zen Center because things are going badly and then fix the problem and then not come anymore. That's not really how it works. It's best to sort of stick around, and even if the problem is fixed, keep practicing. Keep practicing. You know, this is not a self-help program. For instance, if you've been in retreat for, say, 5 days and you've gone through some great difficulties, but by the fifth day you're feeling just great. You're feeling ecstatic. You're feeling wonderful. That doesn't mean you go out for a walk around the lake and start enjoying life. You don't leave the retreat. You stay in the retreat. You continue to do the sitting. You do the sitting through the joy, through the pain. You just keep at it. And I suspect that one reason that first Saturday was so much fun for me was that I had been making a great effort the previous few days. I had probably been doing the work without expectations, which is how I define proper effort. Doing the work without expectations. And so things came easily. And I suspect that after that wonderful day, I, you know, eased up a little bit. I thought, well, I can kind of stop and enjoy this for a while. And eased up on the effort. And you can see where that led. Fifth and finally is we let go of the practice itself. I've been talking all this time about how we need to do the practice, but at the same time, at some point we need to let go of the practice. Last weekend, Red Pine was here, and he said, you have to practice and you have to let go of practice. All of the sutras say this. I wrote that down, which shows maybe I didn't get it, but he also said, there's a practice to practice and a practice to get rid of. What does letting go of practice mean? Well, it means that we're sitting and we're training ourselves. It means at some point we ask, who's doing this training here? Who is it that is doing the training? It's the self. It's the ego. It's the brain. Who is that? Who is that really? Who is that really? Is there anyone there? The training is necessary, but if we never get outside of that brain, outside of that ego, outside of that thing that is doing the training, we won't be doing the deep practice. We have to let go of that voice which is telling us what to do and just do. This is relying on our true nature, as Tim calls it. This is just being. And we all experience this now and then, but I think it takes intense practice to really experience it consistently. So that means letting go of everything that's helped us up to this point. Let go of all concepts. Let go of concepts like heaven and hell. There is no heaven. There is no hell. There's just being. And if I'd been able to do that on this particular Saturday too, I think I would have been more in tune with the moment. I wouldn't have wasted my precious energy on making things be what they weren't. So how do you practice in heaven ultimately? No heaven, no hell, no practice. That's how you practice in heaven. So just to summarize the five, in meditation you see your thoughts and feelings as they arise. You come back to the moment again and again. You do this practice for effort, practice for others. You make a continuous effort. And ultimately, you let go of practice. So all this helps you let go of grasping, which is a way of denying reality. So I hope I've made the distinction clear this morning that there is the joyful experience. There's that pure joyful experience, me having fun with my son on that Saturday. There's nothing wrong with that. That's a wonderful thing. It's what we add to it. It's the grasping that causes us problems. problems. So please don't think about Zen practice as not enjoying life. That would be a mistake. I remember a story that Dosho Port told one time when I heard him lecture. He talked about being down at Hokyoji. He's a priest, and he was with Katagiri, the founder of our center down at Hokyoji a number of years ago. And I think it was evening, and the last sitting of the day was over, and they were walking back to the cabin. And it was just a beautiful night, and the whippoorwills were singing. And Dosho turns to Katagiri and he says, "Isn't Hokyoji beautiful?" And Katagiri gives him this look, Dosho said, as if, you know, have I taught you nothing in all of these years? And it would be easy to misinterpret that, to think that Katagiri is saying, well, you know, don't enjoy stuff, just be even, don't enjoy stuff. But that's not what Katagiri is saying. Katagiri is saying, enjoy it, fully experience it, experience that joy that happens before you give it the name joy, but then don't cling to it. So when Dosho is sort of taking time to say, isn't it beautiful, he's obviously adding something to it. So please enjoy this beautiful life. Please enjoy it fully. That's why we're here. That's what we're here to do. We're here to enjoy this life. We're here to help others. If we can truly enjoy this life and keep coming back to it, we'll be there for others. We'll be here for others. We'll be able to communicate our joy to them and share it with them. So that's what I have to say about practicing in heaven. And I just wonder if there are any comments or any questions. I would welcome them. Yes, Matt.
Thanks for your talk.
You're welcome.
I would just like you to speak about positive and negative, because it seems like you addressed this already in your talk really well. But when you started, you said there's three positive and three negative.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, usually we think of positive as, oh, I want those. But it seems like they're all obstacles to genuinely being in the moment. So would you just talk about that and clarify? Why are they even called positive and negative?
Mm-hmm. I think when they're called positive and negative, that is as a help to our practice. We have to be able to talk about practice in ways that that we can understand in terms of our usual experience. And humans do have a great tendency to classify things as positive and negative. And humans do feel things as positive and negative. We all enjoy some things and maybe recoil from other things. And if we can use that, if we can use that distinction we make to explain the practice, then that's a useful thing to do, I think. We know that ultimately, you know, we're going beyond positive and negative here. But we have to start somewhere. We have to talk in terms of our experience and what we do.
So is it kind of like positive in the sense that you have to be aware of it as positive? Like a cupcake might be positive, and it is enjoyable.
Mm-hmm.
If you eat 12 cupcakes a day, you might make yourself sick.
Right, right.
So it's positive, like be aware of it, don't attach to it. And so maybe it's more of that attachment and aversion.
Mm-hmm.
We tend to be attached to the God realm. We tend to avoid the hell realm.
Right, we're striving to stay in the good ones. We're striving to get out of the bad ones. So. Yeah. Okay. Thanks, Matt. Yes.
I had a similar experience a few years back. The guy that makes my instruments lives in Northern California. I go out to visit him every couple of years, and I'll usually fly into San Francisco, get a rental car, and drive. It's about 150 miles north, and usually I'm 101, which is pretty quick. But one year I decided to take Highway 1, the Coast Highway.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know if you're familiar with it.
It's heavenly.
Yeah. All these windy roads up to above Bodega Bay that kind of straightens out. So I'm driving. It's late September, October, and the weather is perfect. It's about 60 degrees. I've got all the windows rolled down, the radio cranked, got a hooded sweatshirt on to stay warm, and I'm driving, and it's just the sun is going down over the Pacific. It's perfect, absolutely beautiful. And 2 years later, I went again, and I'm going to take Highway 1 again. And basically the same conditions. And I'm about halfway through this drive, and I go, oh, this is pretty boring. You know, I don't know what I was expecting, but this first drive I took was heavenly.
Mm-hmm.
I'll always remember it, but the second time it was nothing
mm-hmm.
at all like it was.
Mm-hmm.
And it was similar temperatures,
right.
Time of day.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think your expectations had something to do with that?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly. I was
yeah.
expecting the same
whole
drive. I mean, it was a nice drive, but it wasn't anything like the first time.
Mm-hmm. And it might have been heavenly that second time, too, if you had been seeing it as it was that particular day.
I think you're right about that.
Yeah. Thank you. Stacy.
I think this is exactly what your talk was about, but I'm going to ask you to clarify the idea of letting go of practice
mm-hmm.
and not being necessarily no longer practicing. And that perhaps in a God realm, we think we know how to do it and how to tell others how to do it, but we still need to maintain our practice. So I guess how to let go of practice and practice.
How to let go of practice and practice. Yeah. Well, you have to do both, and it's hard. And it's hard to know, you know, when. But I think that's wisdom, is knowing when to practice and when to let go of practice. During Sesshin, I think it becomes especially apparent, you know, during a long retreat, because it's easier to let go of practice then, and to just be, but just being so easily strays into sort of distraction, you know. Just being can be even letting the thoughts in, you know, letting the thoughts in and not pushing them away and having the thoughts, and that can be our practice. But that so easily becomes indulging the thoughts and letting one thought lead to another. Then it's time to make that effort again. Then it's time to come back to the practice. It's just something I think we have to learn to do over and over. You know, it's from experience. We just have to learn to do it. It's not easy, and we have many missteps. Does that make sense?
It does. So do you think that there's no longer an effort then as you've let go of practice?
We can talk about letting go of effort. And I know I said we make continuous effort, so this may sound a little contradictory, but I think there is such a thing as letting go of effort and just being.
It's kind of like a paradox. I mean, it's I think you said at the beginning of your talk, which I thank you for, everything can turn into an obsession in practice, I think. You know, trying to get the right words and make sure we're doing it right and meditating right and doing, you know, and being kind of trying to be like the perfect Buddhist or the perfect, you know. And so I think what you're saying, at least what I hear you saying, is that these are good practices to get us to be open, you know, to the path of enlightenment, but also that, you know, they, like anything, can, you know, if we obsess with them or, you know, get really tied into them, we lose actually what they're trying to tell us to do.
Mm-hmm.
If that made any sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's that. There's getting attached to practice so that it actually becomes an impediment. There's also practice is giving it a name. Practice is giving our experience a name. And as soon as we give it a name, we're not really with it anymore. Yeah.
Exactly.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Okay. Yes.
Thank you for your talk.
You're welcome.
I live with two friends, my dear friend PJ and my dear friend Ashes. At least once a night, PJ will settle himself in somewhere around my face and reach over and try to wash my nose.
I see. This is a cat? Okay. Just wanted to be sure.
So I have to move him down toward the end of the bed. And, of course, he'll stay there for a few seconds until he thinks I've dropped off to sleep again. And then he'll come back up and I can move him back down again. So I guess a question that occurs to me is, in what realm is PJ when he's trying to wash my face?
Well, not the animal realm, as we've defined it here. Let's see. I think it's a good question. I would say the human realm. I think your cat is in the human realm. I think your cat is just practicing, just being. I think your cat is awake. What do you think?
Yeah, 3:15 in the morning, you certainly.
Yes, one more.
I think he tried to be a pretty booty cat.
Excellent. Well, thanks everyone for. Oh, okay. Yes.
I would suggest fighting Satan.
Okay, thanks everyone.